Welcome to the WebMD Health Discovered podcast. I'm Dr. Neha Pathak, WebMD's Chief Physician Editor for Health and Lifestyle Medicine. Today, we'll discuss a problem that affects millions of Americans every night, and by extension, every day: insomnia. The CDC tells us that most adults need at least 7 hours of sleep every night. And the American Academy of Sleep Medicine recommends 7 or more hours in alignment with your circadian rhythm for optimal health. But 1 in 3 American adults are not getting the recommended amount of sleep. And according to a recent YouGov poll, 36% of Americans say they use a sleep supplement or medication to help them sleep every night. Ranging from short-term disruptions to persistent challenges, insomnia comes in various forms. We'll be discussing causes, symptoms, and the impact of factors like screen time and caffeine during the day on sleep. But first, let me introduce my guest, Dr. Michael Bruce. Dr. Bruce is a clinical psychologist, diplomate of the American Board of Sleep Medicine, and a fellow of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. He has been in private practice as a sleep doctor for nearly 25 years and is a sought-after lecturer, and his knowledge is shared daily in major national media worldwide, including The Today Show, Oprah, and for 15 years as the sleep expert on WebMD. Welcome to the WebMD Health Discovered podcast, Dr. Bruce.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
All right. Well, before we dig into our questions, how'd you sleep last night?
I asked that question to a lot of people. Very few people ask me that question. I slept great. I flew in from New York. I got in around, unfortunately, midnight, and I'm a very consistent waker-upper. It doesn't matter where I am. I wake up at 7 a.m., and that's exactly what I did. So it worked out perfect.
So I am looking forward to you getting me and everyone listening to becoming a consistent waker-upper as well. But before we dig into all of my questions, I'd also like to ask you about your own personal health discovery. So what was your aha moment around this passion you have for sleep and educating others around sleep?
I didn't start out wanting to be a sleep doctor. And for folks out there, I took a very circuitous route. I wasn't actually even planning on doing this. So I have a PhD in clinical psychology, and I wanted to be a sports psychologist. I wanted to work with athletes and, you know, do all the cool, fun, interesting stuff. So I was at the University of Georgia getting my PhD, doing kind of a dual degree. I was in the clinical department and the sports psychology department. And I was really interested in this residency program that had eating disorders for athletes, because that kind of combined all of my interests into one. But to be honest with you, I couldn't get in. But they had a sleep track that they had opened up because they had grant money for it from the government. And I had worked my way through graduate school in the electrophysiology department because I've always been interested in behavioral health. And I know how to take apart all those machines and put them all back together. And they're exactly the same machines that they use for the sleep lab. So I got this idea that I would sell myself as a sleep guy, and then I would just transfer as soon as I got there into the sports psychology program. Because, you know, once you're there, it's kind of hard to get rid of you. So I applied, sold myself as a sleep guy. First day, raised my hand. Yes, Dr. Bruce. I wanted to find out about transferring over to that other department. And they said, we had a feeling you might say that. So here's the deal, is your money is tied to the sleep lab. You have to work there for 6 months, otherwise you can't pay rent. So 6 months, you're going to do that. But for the other 6 months, we will let you transfer over to the sports psychology department. I'm like, fantastic. How tough could sleep be, right? I mean, I do it every night. By the third day, I absolutely fell in love with clinical sleep medicine, and I knew I would never change. I help people like this. It's unbelievable how quickly within the world of sleep that you can identify a disorder, get it treated, and have people feel relief. I mean, you know, look, as a classic clinical psychologist, when you're treating depression or anxiety, it can take weeks, months, even years. I literally help people sometimes in 24 hours. It's awesome.
Wow. Well, I am excited for a really good night of sleep tonight. So let's start by just defining the terms we're going to be using. Let's define insomnia. What does that actually mean, and how common is it?
So it's quite common, depending upon how you look at it. So roughly, the data would suggest roughly 30% of the entire population is suffering from some form of insomnia at some time, with 10% being chronic. So when you look at 10% of the population, let's say we're at 350 million people here in the United States, you're talking about 35 million people with chronic, what we call insomnia. And it's interesting because, you know, insomnia can be acute where it's just first notice, and then it can be like long term. And that's the group that's really tough to work with. And in many cases have been stuck on sleeping pills for extended periods of time, which is not my preference at all. But when we look at insomnia per se, we know that it's a decent group of people. And when we want to identify it like criteria wise, I call it the rule of threes. So the way people can think about it is if it takes you longer than 30 minutes to fall asleep, or if you wake up in the middle of the night for longer than 30 minutes, this happens at least 3 days a week, at least 3 weeks in a month, for at least 3 months, that's insomnia.
Is that chronic insomnia?
Yeah, that would be chronic. So the acute is much, much shorter. The acute is usually a 30-day thing, and it usually surrounds a particular event, right? So it could be a wedding, it could be a divorce. So it could be good news or it could be bad news because, you know, eustress, the happy stress, will also keep people awake at night.
Yeah, I think what also confuses a lot of people is because life is not just complete equilibrium and then a stress event. We have so many of these intermittent stress events. So I think for some people, it's hard to tease apart, is this now a chronic problem for me? Or is this, again, just a new event that I just do a couple of things and I'll be kind of back to normal? So can you talk a little about that?
Here's a classic example is new baby shows up, right? And when new baby shows up, nobody's sleeping, right? But after a while, you can't even tell if it's from new baby or it's from, you know what I'm saying, from anything else. And so one of the things that I always tell people is if you get to the point in time where you are actively telling other people besides your spouse that you're having difficulty sleeping, you need to go see a doctor.
Let's talk about some of the common sleep disruptor. So what are some of the really common reasons for sleep disruption?
I kind of think of it in three major categories. So the largest category by far for insomnia is anxiety. I would argue anxiety in some way, shape, or form makes up for 60 to 70% of your insomnia or the insomnia that's out there, right? So it's people with a mild anxiety disorder or a major anxiety disorder that kind of bleeds over into sleep, people who just have general anxiety, like a GAD type of scenario, maybe diagnosed, maybe not. That really takes over a lot because one of the primary symptoms is either monkey mind before falling asleep, right? So it takes them a long time to fall asleep, or wake up in the middle of the night and I'm up for 2 hours or 3 hours and can't go back to sleep. We look at those a little bit differently and we treat those differently as well.
I'm really curious about what role the circadian rhythm or your chronotype plays in as a sleep disruptor or that delayed falling asleep piece.
So there's usually two others. There's an environmental piece. So what's going on in your bedroom? And I look at that by the five senses. So sight, sound, touch, taste, and smell. So if there's anything that of the five senses that's going to affect your sleep, you need to get rid of it because, you know, it's pretty obvious. Like you can't fall asleep, you know, when a train is rolling by. And then the other big area I like to look at is medical. So medical diagnosis or medication on board. Pain and insomnia go together a lot. And many of the pain medications can actually contribute to insomnia in unique ways. As an example, I worked at a pain clinic and many of those patients had a lot of anxiety that their pain medication would wear off in the middle of the night, which happens. And so they would have anxiety pre-bed and finally fall asleep. And then of course the medication would wear off and then they pop up and wake up and now they're in excruciating pain. I would argue that there's quite a few disruptors out there, but if you can compartmentalize them or at least have an active way of handling your anxiety, I think that would probably solve the bulk of issues. So chronotypes fall into insomnia in a fairly unique way. I discovered chronotypes through an insomnia patient. So I had failed with this insomnia patient. When I have patients that fail, I bring them in and I spend extended time interviewing them, trying to see if I missed something or if I needed to refer them someplace or something like that. And when I had this one patient, she turned to me during this interview and she said, if I could just live on California time, I'd be perfect. And I was like, what are you talking about? And she was like, well, my day, I live in Georgia, but if I could basically go to work at 9 o'clock California time, not Atlanta time, my whole life would work out well. And I was like, well, why don't you do that? And she said, my boss wouldn't let me. My husband wouldn't let me. And so we ran an experiment where we said, hey, for a week, can she come in 2 hours later, work 2 hours later, family duties in the morning allow her to sleep, spouse takes care of it. And lo and behold, it turns out she was a very late night out. And that was really what started me thinking about this. So what I discovered was if you can take an insomniac and you can put them inside the correct chronotype, that gives you kind of the guardrails for them to work in and they sleep better.
So then that brings me to what are some of your most high yield questions for someone to sort of ask themselves so that they can identify which bucket do they fall into? And let's leave chronotype aside for the moment.
What I do is before somebody actually sees me, they do a sleep diary for a week. So I have them collecting data for me so that way we can discuss it. To be very honest with you, people are terrible historians for their sleep because they're unconscious, right? That would make sense. So if I have them actually doing something like keeping a diary, what ends up working out really, really well for them is now we've got data and they've also been brought into the process more at that point. And they are part of the scientific evaluation of themselves. So I kind of make them like little mini sleep doctors. And then I teach them, how do you use this tool, this sleep diary, to give you information to then modify your behavior in certain ways to achieve better quality sleep. And so I start with that. I also ask all of my patients prior to coming to see me to go to their PCP and have three different things for blood work. I'm interested in your vitamin D, I'm interested in your magnesium, and I'm interested in your iron, particularly your ferritin, because those are easy, easy insomnia fixes. When somebody's got really low vitamin D and magnesium, half the time I just bring them up to par levels and give them a little bit of guidance, say, hey, go to sleep during these kind of guardrails, and everything works out very, very nicely. Collect data, collect blood. Now I've got a much more clear picture by which to make recommendations.
And so in terms of an additional data point, what you hear a lot of patients talking about right now are the sleep ring. What are your thoughts on using that as a surrogate for a diary?
Great question. So number one, I use both, and I'll tell you why. There's something about people actually physically writing things down and creating this almost Excel spreadsheet where they start to see the data changing that I feel is critical to the entire process. That being said, I get it. Some people don't have that time and energy. And so a lot of times I'll have the ring and this on top of each other to kind of check them out. Also, to be fair, a lot of the trackers aren't as accurate as we'd like them to be. I mean, I've really dug deep into that. I would argue that the Oura ring is probably the most accurate out of all of them right now in terms of being close to full nighttime polysomnography, which for folks out there who don't know what that term means, that's an in-lab sleep test. So the Oura ring is from sleep staging is the closest one to give us that information. And that's where the quality kind of comes in because historically people have only looked at hours. Now we can actually look at number of awakenings. We can look at stage changes. We can look at all kinds of things that I would argue could give you some depth into the quality of the sleep.
Can you talk us through caffeine and some of those sleep killers? What is your general sort of stance around how to time it or how to incorporate that in your life?
Step one, I think for everybody, after you've gotten your blood work and you've done your diary, and let's say everything looks fairly decent, is if you figure out what your chronotype is, try waking up at your chronotypical wake-up time 7 days a week. This is arguably one of the biggest problems that people do is they don't keep a consistent wake-up time. Now, you'll notice I'm not talking about bedtime, okay? I'm only talking about wake-up time, and this is where the circadian rhythmicity falls into play. So when our eyes open up and sunlight hits them, as you know, we have cells in our eye called melanopsin cells, which sends a signal to the brain to turn off that melatonin faucet in our head.
How would one identify what their chronotype is?
Believe it or not, it's genetic. I have a quiz online. It's called chronoquiz.com. It's 30 questions. It takes you 2 minutes. And we give you all the information about it. And here's one of the things that's interesting, because we're talking about external environmental stuff like alcohol and caffeine. One of the primary reasons that I wrote the book, The Power of When, was for people to understand that there is a time when you can use those products successfully without damaging your sleep. There is a timing when those things work out well. So from a caffeine perspective, there's a few things I always like to talk about with people when it comes to sleep. One big problem is for a lot of people, the first liquid that touches their lips in the morning is caffeinated. That's kind of a terrible idea. I tell people you really need to hydrate before you caffeinate, because sleep in and of itself is a dehydrative event. You lose almost a full liter just from the humidity and your breath breathing it out. So I'd much rather you do that. And we also know that hydration is a major factor in sleep in and of itself and for the body to operate appropriately. So I tell people, if you can, wait 90 minutes after you open your eyes for your first cup of coffee. Now, here's the logic. You need adrenaline and cortisol to pull yourself out of an unconscious state. But if you just wait, the cortisol and the adrenaline drop. And when you drink the caffeine, it actually boosts the cortisol and adrenaline, and you get more bang for your buck. Now, when should you stop it? I hope that's your only cup, but I'm not so foolish as to think that that's how that works. The lower level limit for most people, I would say, is 2 p.m. for caffeine. Caffeine has a half-life of between 6 and 8 hours. So 2 p.m., half-life of 8 hours puts you at 10, which means about half of it is out of your system. So you should be okay in terms of your sleep. But again, the earlier in the day that you can get rid of your caffeine, the better. Also, for anybody out there who's my age or older, I'm 56. Our metabolism slow down. And so half-life actually can extend a little bit longer than we might have thought. So for caffeine, I have kind of those rules.
Yeah, no, I think it's really important to think about. And I think that's why really understanding and identifying your own personal chronotype or what actually aligns with when you wake up feeling rested, when you feel like, oh, I slept last night. That's a good thing.
And to be fair, like when I'm looking at a sleep diary, that's the first thing that I look at. Is what's the consistency of their wake up time? Because I know consistently during the week for work or for school or for kids or for life, people have a tendency to get up at one time, but almost everybody sleeps in on the weekend, and that's where I catch them. And that's usually the very first thing to prop up and make consistent. And boy, it has an effect across the entire cycle.
I read a recent YouGov poll that said in the US, 36% of people are taking at least a supplement or some sort of sleep medication.
It's awful. So I want to be very clear. I can get people to sleep without these types of things. This is not an impossibility. Very, very few people have what I call a broken sleeper. Okay. Now, I also want to be clear about something else. There are absolutely appropriate times to use medication to help people with sleep. There's a lot of medical issues out there where it is appropriate to use one of these medications. The problem that we see with a lot of medication use is it's not used appropriately. If I'm going to use a medication, I'm going to use it to break the cycle of the insomnia. Then I'm going to taper them off said medication at a very slow rate. What happens is insomnia is what we call a door handle diagnosis. So when the doctor has their hand on the door and they're just about to leave, that's when the patient says, hey, by the way, I'm not sleeping so good. And so the doctor just, oh, okay. They pull out a prescription pad, they write a script, and they say, take this for 30 days and we'll talk about it at your next visit. 30 days comes by, they haven't made it to their next visit. They've been using the pills and it's been working. What do they do now? They call their doctor and their doctor writes them a script for 3 months because they don't even want to deal. And now they're on for 4 months, 6 months, a year, and they have no skill set other than learning how to take a pill to go to bed. So that's where I think we've come across a real interesting area. Supplementation, I kind of feel like it almost the same way. Why add something that somebody now thinks they've got to use every single day when in fact their sleep universe might be fine in another way? People have done research on several different things and some things work better than others. So as an example, probably the most well-studied supplement at this time for falling asleep would be valerian root. And it's an anxiolytic, so it's an anti-anxiety kind of supplementation. It's not harmful for people. So I do see some people, if they have sleep onset insomnia, so difficulty falling asleep, that's when they might try a valerian type of thing like that. But on the other side of it, the second most popular thing, or the one that I would say has got the most research behind it, is melatonin. I'm just going to tell you, I think it's a problem because number one, it's by prescription only, almost every place but the United States. And it's a hormone. You can't just walk down to the CVS and buy estrogen and testosterone. And there's a really good reason for that. Melatonin falls into that category. I would argue that a lot of people just have no understanding of what it is, the correct dose, when to take it, and they just pop it. And here's the thing, 95% of it is sold in an over dosage format. The appropriate dose based on the data out of MIT is between 0.5 and 1.5 milligrams a night. I can't find it in a gummy in less than 3. And then what's happening is they're getting nightmares or it's not working for them, when in fact there are certain cases, jet lag, shift work. Also, for folks my age and older, we do see a slight melatonin decline in some people. So supplementation there could be useful. There are useful times to do supplementation, but I would argue that's going to be at the end of it all for me. I'm going to try things behaviorally, understanding what's going on in your body first, and then kind of get there. Alcohol is considered the number one sleep aid in the world. More people drink themselves to sleep than anything else. Alcohol destroys stage 3-4 sleep. It just annihilates it. For folks out there who don't know, stage 3-4 sleep is your physical restoration. Real cellular repair occurs during stage 3-4 sleep. Also, the glymphatic system is big there, right? And remember, the glymphatic system is kind of the waste management system of the brain. So it comes in, it pulls out all the beta amyloid and the tau and things like that so that people can avoid Alzheimer's. So we really do want to focus more on that, if at all possible.
Just kind of piggybacking on that concept, a lot of people are using screen time as that aid to put themselves to sleep.
Which is not such a great idea because of the blue light. But to be fair, it's not the blue light that's killing the sleep with the screen time. It's the engagement. If you're trying to get your high score on Candy Crush, you ain't trying to go to bed. I tell people all the time, like, you need runway to land the plane. And I don't know what that runway is for you. It's going to be different for different people. I created this concept that I call a power down hour. Let's say you go to bed at 11, set an alarm for 10 o'clock, and then at 10 o'clock, go into your bedroom and chop that hour up into 3 20-minute segments. 20 minutes just for whatever you got to do that next day. And then 20 minutes for some form of meditation, relaxation, prayer, watch television, read a book, just as long as your level is slowly progressing downwards. The big metric that most people don't understand is you need a heart rate of 60 or below to enter into a state of unconsciousness. So if you are trying to get your high score on Candy Crush, you don't got a heart rate of 60 or below, right? If you're reading Facebook and learning about all your friends, you don't have a heart rate of 60 or below. And so that's really the game plan here. And there's one more thing that I wanted to talk about insomnia in particular and why it's so important to wake up at the same time every day. When you wake up at the same time every day, your brain turns off melatonin, but it sets a timer for 14 hours later. And so the time that you get up is directly proportional to the time that melatonin restarts. So as an example, if you're waking up at 6 a.m., about 14 hours later is 8 a.m. That's when melatonin kicks off, takes about 1.5 hours to get going. You get sleepy around 10, you fall asleep. But if you wake up at 8 a.m. instead of 6 a.m., that doesn't go off until 10 o'clock, which means your body doesn't start to get sleepy until midnight.
I never heard it put so succinctly, so that's really helpful. So we've talked about that environmental bucket. So you've given us quite a bit of tips for that. We've talked about some of the physical health problems, so pain. Talk to us a little bit about when you would need to talk to your healthcare professional about a sleep study.
One thing I will tell you is it's pretty rare to do a sleep study for somebody with insomnia. When you go into a sleep study, they attach 27 electrodes all over your body. They put a video camera on you. You're sleeping in a strange room with somebody watching you. If you didn't sleep well before, you're really going to sleep well like that. We use sleep studies for insomnia as a last resort when we think, oh, maybe it's underlying sleep apnea, or maybe it's a variant of a circadian phase delay or something like that. And so when we run out of ideas and methodologies and ways to identify whatever is going on with the patient, that's when we would use a sleep study for insomnia. But as a general rule, I almost never do sleep studies for insomniacs because it doesn't really do me a whole lot of good.
Just a final question about that anxiety component. And is that where we really think about CBTI?
Yeah. And so anxiety, like, I mean, I hope I emphasize the point. I really think it's a large portion. And I also think that insomnia is multifactorial, right? Like, I've never met an insomniac who didn't have some component of anxiety to them, but it's rarely the only thing that's kind of going on there. So I think that for folks, if you can find ways, shapes, and forms in your day to keep your anxiety low, it's going to pay dividends for your sleep. So for me, that is waking up consistently, working out every day. Now, to be fair, you don't have to run a marathon, but daily exercise is one of the best ways to improve sleep quality. Remember, we're not always interested in quantity as much as we are interested in quality of sleep. Meditation is another great one for lowering anxiety. That can be a great way to give yourself that runway to land the plane.
That's great. I love to close all of my episodes with bite-sized action items for our listeners so they can create sustainable changes starting today or tonight. So you've given us a bunch, but could you give us a few more?
I'm going to give you a 5-step plan that everybody can use, and it's going to be super easy to remember. So step number one, pick one wake-up time and stick to it. Step number two is to stop caffeine by 2 p.m. Step number three is to stop alcohol 3 hours before bed. Step number four is to exercise daily, but don't exercise within 4 hours of lights out because your core body temperature is too high. And step number five, when you wake up, take 15 deep breaths, drink 15 ounces of water, and get 15 minutes of sunshine. If all you did was that 5-step plan, I can promise you the quality of your sleep will improve dramatically.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bruce. Really appreciate your time. We've talked to Dr. Michael Bruce about his 5-step plan for attacking insomnia tonight. To find out more information about Dr. Michael Bruce, visit sleepdoctor.com, and we'll have the link to your website in our show notes. Thank you so much for listening. Please take a moment to follow, rate, and review this podcast on your favorite listening platform. If you'd like to send me an email about topics you're interested in or questions for future guests, or more questions for Dr. Bruce, please send me a note at webmdpodcast@webmd.net. This is Dr. Neha Bhatak for the WebMD Health Discovered Podcast.